Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined, of course, by the of late very irascible and disaffected Jeremy Goldcorn.
What are you talking about, Kaiser?
Are you working up a big head of steam for this week's show?
No, not at all.
Oh, you see.
In a very mellow mood.
Oh, good, good, good. Well, because we are very pleased to welcome Mark Leonard, co-founder and director of the European Council on Foreign Relations. Mark was the author of the 2008 book, What Does China Think?, and editor most recently of China 3.0, a collection of 15 essays by Chinese economists, academics, think tankers, and public intellectuals representing a very diverse range of ideologies currently in play on the Chinese stage. Thanks so much for joining us, Mark.
It's great to be here.
Now, I hope this is going to be just the first of many visits to come.
Me too.
Okay, good, good, good. So, Mark, would you first give our listeners some quick background about the European Council on Foreign Relations and its work?
So it was set up 5 years ago, and it's the first pan-European foreign policy think tank. We've got seven offices around Europe in Berlin, Paris, Rome, Madrid, Warsaw, London, and Sofia. And the idea behind it is to try and give Europeans a sense of the big changes that are going on in the world and to try and get them to come together behind an effective foreign policy so that they can try and shape the future of the world rather than as well as understanding it. So that's so we've got big teams of people working on China, on the Middle East and North Africa, on the post-Soviet space and Turkey, and as well as cross-cutting issues like defense and security matters.
Is it in any way deliberately patterned on the US CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations?
I suppose the thinking behind it is similar to the thinking behind the Council on Foreign Relations when it was originally launched, in that that was part of America's coming to grips with the fact that it was going to be a serious player on the world stage. And it was an attempt to move against the introversion and to try and create a strategic culture in the US. And that's what our goal is. But in terms of how we work and the structure of the place, it's probably quite different from the Council on Foreign Relations. And we're certainly not formally linked to them either.
Okay, I see. So there's no direct ties. So let me confess first that as an American living in China and dabbling in China watching, I tend to have this kind of very limited, well, let's call it duopolar, so that I don't have to call it bipolar view of things.
Bipolar perhaps is more appropriate.
Okay, sure. Not in the psychological sense, but so I know that in the comments at the end of this latest volume, it's noted that Europe is mentioned in the included papers exactly zero times, which is about as often as it comes up in conversations I have with friends, even European friends, in discussions about China. So there's, passing reference here and there to Europe's combined status as China's largest trade partner, in conversations. But beyond that, I guess what I'm getting at is, does Europe really matter to China? And, why did you feel it was important to talk to European audiences about this particularly?
Well, I mean, our starting point is more about whether China matters to Europe. But I think Europe certainly matters to China because the Sino-European economic relationship is the biggest economic relationship in the world. For a long time now, Europe has been a bigger market for China than the United States. On a whole series of different issues, it's the relationship between Europe and China which will be a key bit of decision-making on whether it's rebalancing the global economy, whether it's dealing with climate change or thinking about particular problems from Syria to Iran to the future of the Middle East. I mean, increasingly, that relationship is going to become more and more important, particularly as the US pivots to Asia. A lot of the questions which are central to China's economic future, they're going to have to be dealing more and more with Europeans because Europe, it's our part of the world which is going to be increasingly affected. But from a European perspective, China is now not simply a sort of big market that's a long way away where you can make a lot of money. It's becoming very much part of the structure of Europe, with Chinese investment growing, with China playing a more active role in global government. It does affect European policy in pretty much every single area, whether it's domestic or foreign policy.
Can I ask a sort of extension of that? Do you think that the Chinese government actually sees Europe as a coherent organization that they can negotiate with? Because I get the sense sometimes in Beijing from diplomats and journalists that even though there is an EU delegation here, which has, I think, the status of an embassy, the Chinese prefer to deal one-on-one with individual European countries.
Right. I mean, why not, right? After all, they're a lot smaller, and then Europe altogether is...
No, that's true. It's one of the reasons why Europe doesn't punch its weight is because in many areas they don't work as a single whole. I mean, Chinese tend to see the world as it is, so they see Europe as a single force on trade issues because Europe is united on trade. There is a single person who negotiates for the European Union on trade. But in every other area, it's a mix of different countries. And the big relationship which seems to have emerged in recent times is the relationship with Germany, because Germany is such a key market China's a key market for the Germans, and Germany's a really important source of technology. So there is a sort of very symbiotic relationship between those two countries, which has led to some attempts to create more of a political dynamic as well, with Wen Jiabao and Angela Merkel hanging out together and joint meetings of the Chinese and German cabinets, etc.
And is there a reason that you didn't actually include a paper from some sort of a leading thinker, one of your foreign policy folk? Presumably you know somebody for whom Europe is an issue.
Well, I mean, the purpose of this book was more to bring to life the range of debates which are going on within the Chinese elite for a European audience. And though I think, as I just said, that Europe is actually quite important for China, I think it would be stretching it to argue that the debate about how to deal with Europe was one of the key issues facing Xi Jinping and other leaders as they come into office, and one of the schisms which is dividing Chinese society.
Fair enough. Although I think that is almost an English attitude of humbleness that no American editor would have thought that way.
I have to, as an American, I would certainly agree with that. I mean, even in our deepest isolationist period, we still believed. Right. Anyway, let's get back to the actual collection, which, well, first of all, I thought was terrific, and I very much thank you for putting this together. I want to look at the notion behind the title of the collection, the notion of different versions of China 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0, which is, of course, the title of the collection. How did you define and demarcate those? And is this your nomenclature, or is this something that came from a Chinese source?
I don't know whether you guys agree with it, but I've got the feeling the last couple of years when I've been coming to China that we live in sort of end times. There is a feeling that China is coming to the end of an era, not just the end of the Hu Wen era, but something bigger. And that was reflected in a lot of articles and papers which Chinese intellectuals have given over the last period of time. Pan Wei, for example, wrote a piece on the end of the opening and reform era. Wang Shaoguang wrote a really interesting piece, which is in this book, on the idea of socialism 3.0.
Right.
And other people have done similar things, which kind of indicate that we're on the cusp of a new era in Chinese history. And the Chinese love to think about things in these sort of three-decade blocks. So I stylized it a bit, but basically the idea is that China 1.0 is the beginning of modern China under Mao, where the country is united with a command state-planned economy, a political system which is well known, and a foreign policy at that time which was largely about preserving security at home and the revolution at home and spreading global revolution around the rest of the world.
Sure, and that ends neatly in 79, of course, with the
49 to 79, the first 30-year chunk.
Sure.
And then the second 30-year chunk, also relatively easy to define, from 1979, the period of opening and reform under Deng Xiaoping. And there you have an economic policy which is about opening and reform, creating the embrace of the market, export-led growth, investment powered by financial repression. And then in political terms, the quest for stability, particularly after 1989, and the foreign policy, which was largely driven by economic needs and a desire to create a benign environment for Chinese development so that China could amass comprehensive national power. So,
I guess I would add to that, it was also the sort of the era of the technocrat. It was the era, right?
And the basic sense that I get when I talk to Chinese intellectuals is that we are now living with a crisis of success, in that each of the three goals of the Deng Xiaoping era has been achieved and is turning into a problem. So
Hegelian.
It's
so Hegelian.
So in the economic realm, you know, the whole idea was about creating a Shaokang society, but affluence is now there, and it's become a trap because people realize that this model based on exports and investment lay on a foundation of financial repression, and it's quite difficult to see how you can actually rebalance the economy without moving away from those particular drivers of growth, which are unsustainable, but also leading to the forced immiseration of a large number of people within China. And that's why Wang Xiaoguang, for example, one of the intellectuals in here, uses J.K. Galbraith's idea of the affluent society, which produced private wealth and public squalor, to explain the kind of affluence crisis.
So before we get too deeply into the three traps, which is great, I mean, which is a really, really interesting piece of your whole model, let's talk a little bit about that contribution to it. I mean, you actually, I think of particular interest to China watchers was your taxonomy, if you will, of Chinese ideology, how you plotted people along different continua, along these three axes, if you want, you know, corresponding to economics, as you were talking about just now, a kind of statist versus individualist or sort of universal values orientation, what I would call just, you know, roughly a political spectrum, and then a foreign policy orientation. And what I thought was really refreshing about this, so you've got your neoliberals and then your new left on the one hand, you've got and let's be clear that, of course, that camp isn't itself, you know, easily treated as a monolith. You've got, you know, people who don't shirk from statist coercion in the maintenance of stability. And then on the other hand, you've got the universal values people. And then you've got kind of a hawk and dove continuum as well, right? I know that's an oversimplification of things, but would you think that's...
Yeah, no, I think one of the frustrating things for me about the debate on China is that traditionally in the West, we've had a sense that as China becomes richer and more developed, it will become more like us. There is a single sustainable model of human progress. So therefore, the best way of understanding China is to divide people into reformers who obviously share our values and want to become like us, and conservatives who hark back to the time of Mao and basically are against the market, against reform, and don't want to be like us. And that does no justice to the range of views in a country where one in five of the world's population lives. And my collection of essays also actually only covers a tiny bit of the intellectual spectrum in China. But what it does try and do is show that within the elite, you've got a much more complex set of views going on. And so in each of those three areas, I tried to talk about the different groups that are going on.
You left out the fringe, right? There's no fringe here. These are all, you know, reputable thinkers.
It's not just that they're reputable thinkers. They're also people who've made an accommodation with power. So this doesn't include any dissidents. It doesn't include any of the people who are in exile, in prison, whose views are
Who I don't mean to dismiss as a fringe, but right. I know what you mean.
But we could use the word mainstream. I mean, that's the word they'd probably use. They're mainstream enough anyway to be active in China.
But it's not just that. It also, as you say, doesn't include the fringes. So, you know, there aren't any, you know, if you talk to most people about foreign policy issues, for example, their views are probably much more assertive and more nationalistic than the views which are contained in this volume.
Fortunately, they're not the ones who are making decisions.
One thing, if I may nitpick a little bit, is could you really define Wang Hui as a neo-Maoist? I mean, because it seems to me that he's a leftist, but he doesn't, unlike some other thinkers, he doesn't really look back at a certain form of populist leftism, of certain types of ways of engaging or suppressing the people that would be truly neo-Maoist.
I mean, he's committed to social justice. He's committed to, you know, inequality of outcomes and that sort of thing. Is that Maoist?
What I mean in that section, basically, what I tried to do is to show the big divides in the different areas. So in economics, for example, the main difference is about what it is not, again, I don't look at the big kind of differences, the whole spectrum. I look at basically the new left and the new right, who, and that's questions about distribution, what the market's for, rather than people who are opposed to the market. In politics, which is what you're talking about here, I think the big divide is between people who see the source of future legitimacy of the government coming from limiting the power of the government, so liberals, and people who think that actually the key problems facing the government are not so much liberal constraining of the exercise of power, but the fact that things have become too bureaucratic, too collective, that you have technocrats in power, and therefore, in order to re-legitimate the government, you need to have political an injection of political energy in there. And that's where Wang Hui, for example, who is a good friend of mine, I think he's neo-Maoist in the sense that he thinks the solution is going back to the mass line. It's having a different role for the Communist Party. He is against the idea of splitting the party from the state. In fact, he has this notion that one of the big problems for the legitimacy of the system in China is that the party has become a shadowy extension of the state. He talks about the state party. Mm-hmm. And he thinks that the way of actually restoring legitimacy to the state is through using the party to re-engage with society and to become much more political. Because he thinks the state is rotten, corrupt, bureaucratic, that if you go for the rule of law, it won't actually work to run out to deal with corruption. And that's why he, for example, was very pro what Bushi Lai was doing in Chongqing, because he thought that he was working against the system and actually challenging it through the party. And in that narrow sense, I think he's a neo-Maoist.
Would he self-identify as a neo-Maoist?
Well, ask him.
Oh, I'm sure you have, though, right? I mean, I know that there are some of these that in the introductions to the essays you do talk about their self-identification, or at least their lack of objection.
I think
neocom,
yeah,
for example.
The nomenclature is complicated. For example, the New Left. When I first got to know Wang Hui and other people who are called New Left, they hated the idea of the New Left because at that stage, left was a term of abuse, and they quite rightly understood that they were being called New Left as a way of delegitimating them. But the intellectual landscape has changed so much in the last decade that being on the left is no longer a source of abuse. And they then actually themselves started calling the neoliberals, because the neoliberals at that stage were just called liberals. And they said, actually, that's not fair. We're liberal as well. Why should you guys be able to claim the mantle of liberalism? So they started calling the neoliberal economists the new right. And they actually embraced the term of the new left. On the neo-Maoist front, I don't know. All I know is that people like Cui Jian and Wang Hui and others have actually started talking about the mass lines. They embraced the kind of Maoist revival in Chongqing.
I think fair enough, you've made your case, Mark. Yeah. Mass okay. line plus Mass embracing line, yeah. Chongqing model. That's good enough.
You meet the Jeremy Goldcorn definition of a Maoist. So much as saying the word mass line unironically.
Yeah, that pretty much puts you there, doesn't it?
Okay, so we know the direction of the vectors that you're talking about. We know, like, you know, who these different camps are, what their ideas are, but we don't really know their weight or their magnitude. Can you give us a sense for how widespread these different positions are in their respective fields? For example, you know, I mean, is Hu Shuli winning the argument, you know, in terms of the economic spectrum? There are the neoliberals more dominant in influential positions, or is the new left?
I think we're at a period of flux. I mean, that's the part of the idea behind this collection of essays. So I think it's too early to tell exactly where the state's going. But I think if you think about it over a longer period of time, you know, in the 1980s, the ideas of the and in the 90s, the ideas of the neoliberals and the new right were so prevalent and so dominant mm-hmm. that. In fact, if you talk to the new left thinkers, they talk about that period as the period of the dictatorship of the economists.
Right.
Because the economists were all pretty much neoliberal and they were so much more important than any other part of the intellectual landscape, because the main task was about economic development and they were the ones who had the answers and who were driving things. And then, you know, over the last decade, there has been a gradual shift away from neoliberal thinking with much more focus on inequality, on the problems of the market rather than the problems of socialism. And you saw certainly the rhetoric which Hu and Wen deployed was completely different from their predecessors. And the new left ideas seem to become much more part of the mainstream. And if when I was talking to people, neoliberal economists like Zhang Weiying, for example, who's right. the author, they were very depressed a few years ago. He used to say, particularly also this coincided with the rise of the internet and social media, and they felt that they were the butt of attacks from all sorts of different sources. So the kind of mainstream discourse became one much more about problems of affluence, problems of the market, rising inequality, corruption, rather than the problems of socialism. And this kind of reached an apotheosis with Bushi Lai emerging as the most popular politician in China, and everybody going to Chongqing to pay homage to this new brave new world, which was this republic of consumption, which was being created in Western China, which was going to mark out a different future. And then, so that was very much the sense that one had. And then, obviously, in fact, one of the mistakes of the new left, I think, was to embrace Bushi Lai too much, so that they became very associated with him and he became a symbol of what they were talking about. And people like Cui Xuan, who wrote an essay in this, actually even moved to Chongqing, got seconded
That's
to
right.
the administration. So when Bushi Lai crash landed earlier this year, that obviously created a massive crisis for them.
So, I mean, all this is leading up to what you're going to a swing back in the other direction now, the neoliberals back in ascent.
Well, it's too early to tell, I think.
Let's look at some of the indicators. I mean, okay, what did we have just the other day? And I'm proud to say I called this, but we had that Southern Tour moment announced, right? And where does he decide to go? Obviously, he's not going to make this about rebalancing and going to a consumption capital like Chongqing. For political reasons, he can't, but it's Shenzhen again, right?
Yeah.
Jiang Zemin has picked or the conventional wisdom says that it's Jiang's men all in power again. I mean, people who are associated with coastal development, with foreign direct investment, with very, very much the neoliberal party line.
Well, that's one of Wang Hui's got an essay in here where he actually predicts that, and he says that he harks back to the situation in 1992 and says that, you know, what happened after Tiananmen was because before Tiananmen you had a straightforward division between conservatives and reformers, and what happened after Tiananmen was that the reformist camp split into two, into the new left and the new right, and the new right were willing to make an accommodation with
state power, right?
With state power in order to liberalize the economy. And the new left, a lot of them went into exile, Wang Hui
for example,
included. And basically, he sort of disappeared until who and when came into office. And he asked the question after what happened to Bushilai whether we're on the phase of another period where you're going to have a wave of privatizations, a shift towards neoliberal economics, and that the purging of Bushilai and the return to collective government will create the political conditions for that. But at the same time, I think that the societal pressures for dealing with inequality and with social problems, and the fact that the export-based, investment-based economic model, which is underpinned by financial repression, that has come to an end. So those pressures are going to be there. The problems of the market are much more prevalent now than they were when Jiang Zemin was in power. So
your use of the word financial repression really kind of gives away your sympathies here. But that's
well, no, I mean,
I mean, we can call it that. Sure, I mean, I'm okay with that.
Well, no, it's Nick Lardy. I think I don't know if he coined the term, but he uses it a lot. But the idea is that if you have artificially low interest rates, that means that people's savings. People don't get a fair return on their savings.
Mark, I've been living in China for 17 years, and I feel financially repressed. So I endorse the term.
I think everyone listening understands your use of the term, that it is a politically neutral one. I was trying to make a joke, but
sorry,
that's quite a lot. And I didn't mean to derail you from this, but I want to move on to another quick question here.
Okay.
Were there any of these essays that you found to be particularly compelling? Or not just you, of course. Let's look at your editors, your colleagues. Who have you gotten? What essays have really sort of sparked conversation? Have made people really sort of sit up and take notes? Either positive or negative reaction.
Talk about a few of them. One in the political realm, which. Has certainly got a lot of people thinking is there's an essay by Pan Wei and Shang Ying
on a new
approach to stability preservation, which is extremely controversial neoconservative take on the problems of stability. And he rejects all of the prevailing explanations for why there is social instability. He says it's got nothing to do with a middle income trap. It's got nothing to do with an absence of political reform. He posits a different account, and he basically argues that the problem facing China at the moment is that you have a bureaucratic state which has become alienated from ordinary people and is unable to deal with the small and the trivial things which trouble them in their everyday lives. He says that the Communist Party state is very good at making the big decisions but can't deal with trivial things. And it's the trivial things which lead to social instability and which ultimately could lead to the regime collapsing. And he says that the problem is that the natural communities which acted as a glue within China were first killed by Mao and then by the market.
Right.
And his solution, therefore, is, in fact, a return to our old friend, the Mass Line.
What a bizarre argument, though. I mean, it was such a – I don't know. I read that, and I just kept sort of – I kept feeling sort of gobsmacked, just like, Mike, is this guy living in the same reality that I am? I mean
– But absolutely. Anyway, that was completely opposite from sort of Sun Li Ping, who gives a much more democratic account of – but I think is something which is kind of – interesting, and which got a lot of people talking and thinking, and particularly the fact that actually it's an argument which seems to have appealed to quite a lot of people in influential positions within China. Another piece on in the political realm, which I think is more familiar ground to you, but which certainly a lot of people in Europe were interested in, was Michael Ante's piece on the way the net and the way that the internet is actually empowering the one-party state rather than leading to the inevitable collapse of the
Nazi state. Anti has been selling this line for a while, and I've come to completely agree. I think I was pretty persuaded immediately, and I arrived at that same conclusion about how resilient they are. How I mean, he uses that battlefield metaphor again and again.
Well, I must say, I keep on harping on about this essay, but that argument was really first put by Sang Ye and Jeremy Bame in 1997 in the essay in Wired magazine that coined the term the Great Firewall. So I would say that I've been in agreement with it a long time, but it's not a new argument.
Right. But I mean, nor is it as
But Antti makes it very well, I think, and he's explored a number of the subtleties of it, and particularly the way it works in the age of Weibo, which is, of course, a new thing.
It's a good sort of counterweight to the prevailing techno-utopian argument, but I don't think that it should be read in and of itself as definitive.
Agreed, but the techno-utopian argument is still this. The conventional wisdom in many Western capitals. So
yeah, sure.
I would say all Western capitals.
So that's in the political one. In the foreign policy realm, there's a great essay by Yan Shui Tong, which is kind of deliberately controversial. But what it does show is, I think, that a lot of the assumptions about how Chinese foreign policy was going to work are completely out of date now. I mean, he basically starts by positing that we're no longer in the multipolar, we're not moving towards the multipolar world, which Chinese foreign policy has been about creating. We exist in a bipolar world. And he says that in this era of bipolarity and strategic competition with the US, China needs to rethink literally all of its foreign policy principles. So to get rid of the primacy of economics, that great power politics is more important than economic growth, that you need to rethink non-alignment and actually have alliances with different countries. He puts forward a completely different notion of responsibility from Bob Zelick's responsible as a stakeholder idea, right, and says that China should give nuclear guarantees to North Korea and other countries. And he also talks about rethinking the principle of non-intervention and saying that, China can't afford not to intervene in other countries around the world. So it's quite a revolutionary piece. And if
right, I want to take back a little bit what I said about not having included any fringe thinking.
Well, actually, interesting. The thing about Yan Shui Tong is he's a controversialist. He has he enjoys taking up hawkish positions. In fact, I mentioned one of my first encounters with him when I'd been in China for a few days talking to people about EU-China relations, and everyone was speaking in very polite terms about strategic partnership and other sorts of things. And I asked Yan Shui Tong, what do you want to get out of Europe? And he said to me, without batting an eyelid, he says, when we go to war with America, I'd like you to at least stay neutral. I don't think we can.
I love that line.
We can ask for more than that. But at the same time, if you look back at the last 20 years or so, he's been pretty, though he's hawkish and he's quite hard-lined in some things, he's been very creative in his thinking, has been one of the first people to embrace a lot of the more interesting moves in Chinese foreign policy. So 15 years ago, for example, in fact, before that, Yan Shui Tong was pushing the idea of Asian regionalism and the idea that China should... He spotted a gap in the market. He could see that the United States was against regional integration and was uncomfortable with regional integration. And he spotted an opening for China, and he said, we should support multilateralism, regional integration, what became the new security concept. That's when he was a researcher at KICA, the China Institute for Contemporary International Relations, which is related to the State Security Ministry. But anyway, he said that China should embrace regional integration as a way of being able to rise and to develop its military and other capabilities without scaring its neighbors.
Right, and they've not scared any neighbors, of course. So how's that working out for them?
It worked out very well for until a while, 2010. Right. And then obviously things have been less good in recent periods.
The bovine tongue came and licked that problem away.
But he also was one of the first people to think about soft power in a operational way. I mean, he's somebody who is actually unusually good at spotting trends before they arrive. So even though some of the other authors in here on the foreign policy things like Wang Jisu, who are more cautious, maybe closer to the sort of foreign policy establishment.
Sure,
views.
Yeah, he's.
I don't
he's
think
sort of...
you can just discount him as a fringe, as a fringe figure. But anyway, that's another one which was kind of had some sort of impact. And then the on the economic front. Sorry, I don't know if you want to.
No, go on. Just very quickly though on the economic front.
Well, some of those pieces also created quite a lot of debate, particularly the one I started with at the beginning, Wang Xiaoguang's one on Socialism 3.0, because it expressed very clearly a lot of the problems with the Deng Xiaoping economic model, and also used this idea of the affluent society and J.K. Galbraith in quite an interesting...
I thought that one was interesting, too. I thought that the Zhang Weiying and apologies to Hu Shulid, I thought those two were really... There was nothing substantial in them. It was just a restatement of essential neoliberal takes on things. Let me move... since we're slightly running out of time here, and I do want to ask you about this. What do you make of Xi Jinping's recent, use of this word? This is something we talked about on the show last week, Jeremy and I did, about this the great renewal of the Chinese nation, Zhonghua Minzu De Wei Da Fuxing. My assertion of this is that the phrase was not merely rhetorical. I mean, Jeremy and I got into it last week, and that you could actually read quite a bit into it. And so I actually unconsciously borrowed from that framework that was still fresh in my mind, you know, having just read your collection the previous weekend. And I suggested that you could actually see what's in store along these different axes, that, you know, maybe this has an economic dimension to it, a political dimension, a geopolitical position that it stakes out. What did you feel when you hear Xi Jinping talking about the great renewal of the Chinese people? What's your take on that? Of the Chinese nation? Yeah.
I think it is a recognition that we are entering a new phase of Chinese development where we're talking about the burdens of affluence and how you deal with that, with how you deal with being a great power, And I suppose the tension which comes out very strongly from this collection of essays is between an increasingly strong country, a strong economy, a strong society, and a weak political system that doesn't have the ability to the question is, I suppose, for him is whether he can renew the political system so that he has a grip on power, so that it has enough of a grip on these kind of big trends which are changing both Chinese society but also the external environment within it. And actually one of my colleagues jokes that we talk about China 3.0 here, but if you look at the 18th Party Congress, what it delivered was China 1.5. and I don't know whether that's what part of what
it's 1.5.3. Let's call it that. Actually, let's move on now. I mean, Mark, thanks a lot. That was a totally great conversation. I really enjoyed that. Why don't we move into the section where we make recommendations and wrap the show today? Mark, as is our tradition here, won't we start with our guest?
I am in the middle, so I haven't finished it yet, but I'm reading a book by Edward Luttwak called The Rise of China versus the Logic of Strategy, which is quite a scary book, which basically argues that the idea that China is going to rise in an inexorable, unresisted way is completely wrong and defies the logic of strategy. And he argues that the problem for China is that China is inevitably going to run into resistance. People are going to try and balance it, are going to stop it rising. You can't carry on growing in parallel economically, in political and diplomatic terms, and in military terms.
It's the China is will mean Germany argument.
It's not. It's actually more the opposite. He's arguing not so much. He's saying the problem's not about Chinese assertiveness and about you know, the fact that we're going to move from Bismarck to Kaiser Wilhelm, and that China is going to be is going to be reckless and do kind of assertive things. He's just saying the very fact that China is big and becoming bigger.
The fact of constrained resources, the fact
whatever policies the Chinese government adopts, it will be scary. And the logic of strategy means that people will try and resist that, and that you will have a breakdown of the free market. And he, because his big idea, which he launched in 1991, is the idea of geoeconomics and of the battlefield between countries being played out on an economic field rather than through military confrontation. Anyway, it's
is that a new book?
It's come out quite recently, yeah, in the last couple of months.
Well, I'm definitely going to have to read it.
It's quite scary, and you won't necessarily agree with everything that's in it, but it's definitely very thought provoking.
Great recommendation. I'm gonna pick that one up, Jeremy.
I got a newish blog, which comes from the author of In the Footsteps of Joseph Rock, which is one of my favorite blogs ever.
Li Zhang.
Which is all about the American botanist, naturalist Joseph Rock and his traipsing through Yunnan. And the blogger,
Michael Woodhead.
Well, was he like,
sort of carried around in a bathtub? Isn't that
I hear many interesting stories. Michael Woodhead has retraced many of his steps around Yunnan. So the same blogger now has a blog called ChineseMedicalNews.com, which is basically a blog. He's a medical journalist professionally, and it's all about news of healthcare, the medical industry, the pharma industry in China, which might sound a bit wonky, but it's really medicine and healthcare. Hospitals are at the heart of pretty much every problem facing China today, from economics to the social safety net to, you know, why do people who murder doctors become heroes online?
Wow. So how did you find this? I mean, how did you?
I'm all over the internet,
you
Kaiser.
Are. You yeah. are. You so, know them tubes.
ChineseMedicalNews.com.
Okay, cool. That's another excellent recommendation. Let me throw mine in here. Mine is actually a review of a book by somebody who was recently on our podcast, Pankaj Mishra, his book, of course, From the Ruins of Empire. And this review is in Dissent and was written by a friend of mine, actually, a woman named Becca Liao, who's an attorney in Northern California, as well as a critic and reputedly a very talented soprano, though I've not heard her sing opera. She's also a contributor to one of my favorite China blogs, Tea Leaf Nation. This recommendation actually ties in very closely with what we've just been talking about because of what I thought was, you know, the best, one of the best pieces by, you know, Wang Hui. The last third of Becca's review is actually all about this, and it sort of ties his perspective on China's rise to Wang Hui's take on the new left's take on historiography. Really, really good stuff. I would highly recommend it.
Can I just also say, if people are interested in the book, it's free. And
oh, yeah,
get it
of course.
I mean, www.ecfr.eu.
And we'll put a link to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been putting this out quite a bit on Twitter and on Facebook, so I think a lot of people have already gotten a hold of
millions.
It.
Millions.
Millions.
Followers.
I am.
We'll overwhelm your servers.
But we're not moving from Bismarck to Kaiser Wilhelm, but to Kaiser Guo.
Kaiser.
Hey, Mark, thanks a lot for coming on. We'll hopefully have you back next time you roll through town.
Thank you very much. It was great fun.
Jeremy, as always, man.
Have a good morning, Kaiser.
Yeah, you too. Yeah, so we're doing a rare Sunday morning podcast. So get out there and enjoy the day. Take care, and we'll see you next week.